What's not good?
Just breaking audio jacks.
Hey, I don't need those.
Nah.
Hello, and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast. On this 202nd episode, this December 3rd, Thursday, 2009, we're very concerned with the future of things in PC gaming. What's in store for Modern Warfare 2's multiplayer now that a handful of terrible glitches have been discovered? What we think Telltale Games should transition into next now that Tales of Monkey Island is closing? What's in store for the Medal of Honor series now that EA has decided to reboot it into the Modern Warfare genre? And what's in store for the future of Command & Conquer now that EA has hinted that it's bringing it into a digital model, whatever that means? I'm your host, PC Gamer's associate editor, Evan Lotti, and joining me is my compatriot, Dan Stapleton, our reviews editor.
Hi, everybody.
Glad to have you, Dan. And likewise alongside me are our capable pair of interns, Eric Belsauce and Prentice Getty.
Hello, everybody.
Howdy.
And fresh off his not last place finish in the Cat Fantastic podcast is former PC Gamer editor-in-chief, Gary Whitta.
Hello.
Glad to have you back.
Glad to be back.
And as always, podcast producer Andy Bauman. Andy, how many podcasts have you been on with, for us with?
That's a good question. Calculated out to about 83, 84.
Ooh.
Plus or minus one for, you know, error correcting.
Of course.
I think I sat in on one extra too, without even recording it. Just to see how it goes. So count that one, maybe 84.
So your magic number is probably like 120 or something to pass Jeremy?
I think so, yeah.
So it sounds like you've got a little bit of a, like a Star Trek original series question there. Is it 73 or 74 or 72 or 73 episodes? Because one was like a two-parter.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I mean, so, it's not a competition, right? Like Jeremy did, you know.
If everything Jeremy is a came competition,
back,
Andy.
If Jeremy came back, he would come back. I would let him have it. If he needed to.
All right, so as I mentioned, we're very concerned with the future of things for whatever reason today, possibly because we work for a company with the same name.
I would call it cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously
about some
optimistic.
Of those things. Not so much. Cause I'm not concerned that I'm concerned might be a little strong.
We're interested in the future.
There we go. That might be a better word.
Very good. Thanks. So first off, probably the biggest announcement this week in gaming in general was that Medal of Honor is coming back. It's not going to be a World War II game. It's coming out next year, supposedly taking place in Afghanistan. And pretty much all we know about it is that you're going to play the role of what they're calling a tier one operator within the military, on the U.S. side, of course.
Man with gun.
Man with gun. Very highly trained, of course, knows what he's doing and fighting terrorists, presumably. That sounds like another game we know about.
What do they mean by tier one, though? Is that like special ops or like marine recon? Like what is it?
It might be super cool.
You know, it could be a military contractor term, like a private.
Oh.
And it's a real thing, right? It's not something they've made up, because in the press release they were saying they consulted with real tier one operators.
Yes.
Okay.
So whether that's internal terminology within the army or a private company, I'm not sure. But either way, you know, very clearly abandoning the World War II genre for this entry, and making an attack on Modern Warfare 2 and, where Call of Duty is gone. Do we think they can be successful with that approach?
I think it was fairly inevitable, wasn't it? I mean, the World War II thing, even though World of War actually did quite well, I think, you know, it was one of the most common complaints in gaming was that people were sick of World War II being revisited over and over and over. And then, you know, Call of Duty and Infinity Ward clearly had decided to try something new. They went modern and had the biggest success ever with it. You know, Modern Warfare 2 has just been a massive, massive success too. It seems like almost kind of a no-brainer that EA would try to copy that formula themselves.
I think that's fair to say. I'm really hoping that they understand that it's correlation, not causation there, right? I mean, the success of Modern Warfare 1, you know, Call of Duty 4, to me, it was the surprising quality of the campaign, the surprising longevity of the multiplayer, and not necessarily the time period. I mean, that helped. That gave them opportunities to do new things outside of raiding bunkers and storming beaches and being in you know, bomb battered towns in France or whatever that we've done in every other World War II game in existence, pretty much. But really, Infinity Ward makes quality experiences and entertainment, you could argue.
Do you think the World War II shooter genre is dead for the moment? I don't know of any other shooters that are for like first person shooters that are in development or coming out anytime soon.
Red Orchestra.
That's definitely the most exciting entry, and I was actually one of the first people to play it at GDC. I'm sorry, last year, and it definitely like strike me as a combination between like a sim and arcade shooter.
Not a multiplayer only. That's not a multiplayer only game.
I think it is multiplayer only.
Oh, okay.
But it's very much centered on like realistic damage modeling and things like that. So that's exciting, separate of being whether World or not War II. It's a dead genre. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been interesting to see the kind of the parallel history of those two franchises too. I mean, Medal of Honor really invented the World War II shooter to begin with, and was successful through several iterations. And I think Call of Duty was kind of Activision's Me Too attempt to cash in on that when Medal of Honor showed that the World War II stuff was very popular.
Isn't there a story there where a lot of the development team or some of the
some of the guys went over from one franchise to the other, yes. And then maybe because of that talent swap, the Call of Duty games then very quickly became preeminent. The Medal of Honor games started to stumble. They had more than a few games that weren't really that great. I think everything after Allied Assault wasn't really that great. You know, they had the Pearl Harbor version. You know, the Japanese Rising Sun wasn't very good, and the Call of Duty games just went from strength to strength, and then they just went into the stratosphere with Modern Warfare. So I think EA's thinking, hey, come on, we kind of invented this. We have our own, military FPS franchise too. Let's go do it. It does feel a little bit like, do we really need another one of these games? And it feels like a little bit of a brazen attempt to cash in on a very popular formula. Although I guess it seems like even though the press release tells you almost nothing, it feels like the tone of this one, they may be going for more realism, you know, especially in Modern Warfare 2. They really just went all completely over the top, almost into like science fiction, Tom Clancy type craziness with the scenarios that you were presented with, you know, Russians invading downtown Washington and stuff like that. If we're talking about these guys being in Afghanistan, given that's a war that we're still currently fighting, I would like to think that they'll treat that scenario with, you know, a little more respect and ground it a little more.
So that this will be a little bit less Michael Bay?
Yes.
That would be nice anyway.
Less Michael Bay and more Steven Spielberg, who was, you know, really the one of the guiding forces behind Medal of Honor to begin with. I think what happened was he did Saving Private Ryan and did Band of Brothers and was keen to kind of expand that into other areas, and that was kind of how Medal of Honor began to begin with.
Yeah, and I think the last Medal of Honor game was Medal of Honor Airborne, and that was a couple of years ago now. So it's been dormant. I guess it does need a revival. There's no reason to really let it go to waste, like a franchise like that.
The guy in that one piece of art that they released so far, I know we've kind of joked that he looks a little bit like a guy from ZZ Top. It does kind of suggest that this might be about mercs, because that doesn't look, you know, I know these guys that are in country for a long time, so they go a little bit native, you know, they grow the beards and, you know, kind of the apparel discipline goes out of the window. But this guy that they put on the artwork they released almost does look like kind of a private contract, almost like a merc rather than a regular military dude.
But that would be insane though, because mercs aren't eligible for the Medal of Honor. seems like a bad choice for that particular.
Maybe you play a character who had earned a Medal of Honor in your previous military career.
There you go. That's the tie-in.
Workaround. Well done. So that's why you earn the big bucks rating.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
But he's a real guy. There were photos came out online. It's based off a real guy in Afghanistan.
Oh, okay.
That picture. Oh, wow. Let me ask you guys.
I don't think they're going to do mercs either, because if they really do have the cooperation of the Pentagon, and you know that's a very, if you forgive the pun, murky area where they don't really like to shine a spotlight on these kind of private soldiers overseas. I think it probably is going to you're going to be whatever these tier one operators are. I imagine there's some kind of like super elite special ops type dudes, whether they be Navy SEALs or Delta Force or Rangers, whatever. I think it might be a little bit like the Task Force 141 they had in Modern Warfare that was kind of just a collection of the most badass dudes. They didn't belong to any particular arm of the military or whatever.
Yeah, it could be. But getting back to the point you made about the talent swap, between Modern Warfare and Call of Duty. It's interesting that DICE over in Sweden is going to be developing the multiplayer.
This is my next point.
They're going to be making the multiplayer for Medal of Honor, which, for one thing, I mean, in the past year and upcoming, DICE has made Battlefield 1943 yet to come out on PC, Bad Company 2 yet to come out on either platform, Battlefield Heroes, they're probably maybe working on Mirror's Edge 2, and now they're doing the multiplayer for Medal of Honor. I mean, wow.
Well, DICE has several studios, so it's a big developer. Although I'm not sure if their Canadian one is still operating. That may have closed down a couple of years ago.
But DICE is kind of like EA's tier one operator, right? It's like they're like their Infinity Ward, right? They're the go to guys if you really want to kind of do an FPS, right?
I think that's the thing, right? Like Modern Warfare came out after Battlefield 2, so they've been to the modern times.
Yeah, and on top of that, I mean, they're sort of saturating the genre. If you think about Bad Company 2, I mean, if you watch any of the multiplayer videos, it does. I mean, it's a more open multiplayer experience. There's destructibility, there's vehicles, but it's still, you know, it's within the same genre, certainly.
What does this mean for Battlefield 3?
There are dedicated servers.
That's true.
Do you think EA senses a little bit of an opportunity here, at least on the PC side, where Activision seems to have burned so many PC players with the no dedicated servers and some of the other choices they made with this new game? There's been a big player backlash that EA is thinking, hey, if we do this right and listen to what the people complained about Modern Warfare 2 doing wrong, and we go and do all those things right, that they might be able to, you know, scoop some of those players up and get people to switch back to Medal of Honor.
I think a few guys at DICE definitely feel that way. I don't think you're gonna see a big push from EA on that front. But like there have been a few, you know, Twitterers out of DICE that are holding up, you know, Battlefield as a game for this crowd. I think that by the time, Battlefield 3 comes out particularly, I think that, you know, this will have blown over. I think that, EA, much like Activision, only really cares about the bottom line. So if doing away with dedicated servers, if they perceive that as being part of raising the bottom line, then they would probably jump on board at that train as well. I don't think that's going to happen though. I think their DICE probably will insist on keeping that.
I'm very interested to see what they're going to do. Unfortunately, the Bad Company 2 beta on PC has been delayed until January. It's supposed to be out in December. I was really looking forward to that. But in the meantime, we have been playing, at least Andy, myself, and Eric have been playing Modern Warfare 2 multiplayer. You know, for the greater good, of course, just to see what it's all about. Please don't chastise us for playing a game that we get for free. And I just want to get some thoughts on it. There's an interesting mention yesterday about this glitch that's out in the wild. It's called the Javelin glitch, I guess. The Javelin's a missile launcher. And there's a certain way you can prime a grenade that if you get shot, even if you're running or, you know, doing a certain action, your javelin will trigger when you die. So you basically explode when you die and kill anybody around you. And it's causing some upset and hurt feelings, I guess, among multiplayer players. But aside from that, how do we feel about it?
I've been playing quite a bit of it, and there's balance issues coming out.
such as
there seems to be two distinct classes emerging. There's the people who use a tactical knife, because during the knife animations, you're invincible. So
awesome.
If you just
That's
run,
awesome,
yeah, yeah, if you just run towards someone and mash your melee button, you're bound to kill like a room full of guys with your tactical knife in Modern Warfare.
There's also another reason is when you're sprinting, it takes a long time for you to reset with your weapon. Yet the knife is instantaneous when you're sprinting.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing I'm seeing a lot of is the last weapon you unlock is like
double
this
shotgun, dude.
The shotgun from 1887.
Oh yeah, that's the most popular weapons loadout.
It's a shotgun, so it deals massive damage, but it's accurate at like 30 yards, and you can carry two of them. And
at the same time, you can dual wield.
Yeah, you can dual wield them, and so it more and more and more. That's all I'm seeing players use because they. Both of these are like absurdly good compared to anything else. So I think they have some balancing issues to work out.
Sounds like Modern Warfare is being overtaken by 19th century weaponry.
That's the irony of it is that that's the class that you see running around in a ghillie suit with dual-wielding 1887 shotguns. You're like, it's kind of actually charming. I don't know. I kind of find it fun.
I find it all quite dispiriting, and this is one of the reasons why I don't play too many of these games online anymore. It's not just that a lot of these players are better than me. I mean, I'll happily admit that they are. It's just that, I don't know, I'm going to sound like an old fogey here, but there's just no sportsmanship, there's no honor, there's no gentlemanly conduct in online games anymore. You know, people will do absolutely whatever it takes to win, you know, not just within the rules, but also, you know, like you said, they'll do these javelin exploits, they'll do these knife exploits, you know, sometimes they'll straight up cheat, they'll do hacks and mods and whatever it takes to win. And there's no honor in it. It's not sportsmanlike. It's just not fun. And, you know, it's a constant battle these days for developers who create these online games. I mean, you can create, you know, a quote unquote perfect system within a single player game that really cannot be exploited. But anytime you open the system up to players, you know, players are like bacteria. They're like germs. Human players will infect any system, and they'll burrow into every little crack, and they'll find every weakness. And, you know, especially when it's a player base as large as Modern Warfare, where you've got literally millions of players, you know, there is always going to be people that find something, some little trick. They will try everything in the game to find some little advantage. And then once it's found, you know, someone posts to YouTube, and then it propagates, and I would despair to be a developer that constantly feels like they have to stay on top of that kind of stuff.
But I mean, like the stuff they're talking about, these seem like pretty simple balance tweaks that Infinity Ward could fix, you know, with a snap of their fingers if they wanted to.
Well, and I think they're doing that. Like they've already said that there's going to be some kind of fix for the javelin glitches coming. Like that's an exploit that I think will be fairly easy to fix. But do you know what I mean, though? It's not just that. It's every little thing that people can find to get ahead. And it just, you know, there's all elements of fairness and fair play just go out of the window. It's just all about, you know, kill or be killed.
Haven't games always had that problem, though?
Yeah, to some extent. But I mean, like guys were saying, that there are more people trying to pick it apart. It happens faster now. Like that there's less time when a game is like everybody's still discovering it. You know, everyone doesn't know every in and out. And for me, that's like the most fun part of playing a multiplayer game when nobody is really, really good at it yet. You're all still like, oh my God, I just discovered this great tactic. You know, and everything isn't known yet.
Yeah, that was definitely the case with Demigod Force. And I'm glad you brought up the idea that players are somehow, you know, they corrupt the multiplayer experience, or it's disadvantageous, if I can use that phrase. I was watching an interview with the guys that made Torchlight recently, and they were asking, you know, why didn't you just put co-op in this version instead of waiting to make an MMO? And they said, in order for us to, like, first of all, these are some of the same guys that made Diablo, and they argued that, you know, within weeks of, you know, releasing Diablo and Diablo 2, the multiplayer was broken because there were people that could duplicate items and just alter their stats and characters and just completely eliminated the fun of developing a multiplayer character. And that was kind of the same fear they had with Torchlight, that they wanted to protect the experience and have control over what the experience was, when they knew if it had multiplayer built in, that players would eventually, you know, hack and exploit their way into basically ruining the fun for other people.
And arguably that's happened with Borderlands.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, there's virtually no protection against cheating in Borderlands and multiplayer. So, but because it's all co-op, the argument is, well, you know, they're not killing you unless you go into a duel with them. So it's not like destroying your really experience. Although, you know, they can create as many of a certain type of weapon as they want. You know, all kinds of hacks, because it's all on their own servers.
You can duplicate profiles, basically, right?
I mean, yeah.
Okay.
It's really easy to hack that game.
Okay.
I don't know, to uncurmudgeon up a little bit, I like the multiplayer experience so far a lot in Modern Warfare 2. I find it refreshing.
Well, in what way?
Because, say, the last multiplayer game I was really, really into was Team Fortress 2, right? And that, these are like, even though they're both sort of team-based multiplayer games, they're drastically different, because in Modern Warfare 2, you just jump in and start playing. You're not so worried about your teammates and forming strategies, and maybe that's a function of the no dedicated servers. But I found myself just jumping in, playing, oh, leveling up, oh, this is great, oh, new gun, all right. And say that guy with the 1887 shotguns kills me a bunch of times, I go, oh, I use my perk that's copycat. Oh, I'll just copycat him and see what it's like to run around with those for a little bit. Oh, it's not that, it's all right. You know, I think there's a lot of good in the multiplayer. And
I think,
you know, Team Fortress 2, you really needed to know your team, play with friends, and it was kind of like, more structured.
No, it's definitely at its heart a fun game. And, yeah. You know, I actually never played the original Modern Warfare. So this is my first time being exposed to this idea of the almost kind of the role-playing element, you know, where you level up your character and you get new boosts and perks and you rank up. And that's definitely a compelling element. It makes you want to play more. I'm just talking about, like, the thing they were complaining about. I think we were talking about it just now, and they complained about it on Penny Arcade, too. This particular, and this is an exploit. It's just a game design weakness that you need to balance out, where there's a particular build that you can make where you've got a certain number of perks for, like, you know, you can run all the time, you've got increased speed, you've got the extra knife perk. You put all those together.
Oh, yeah.
And you can just basically sprint around the map like a whirling dervish, just spanning the knife.
Yeah.
And you can get a lot of kills that way. Now, that, you know, technically the guy has not broken any rules, but I just feel like there's something there. There's something in that play style that's just not in the spirit of the game. But, you know, it kind of is in the spirit of the game, though,
in Modern Warfare 2, because, you know, you're not too worried about... Maybe I'm playing not as, like, competitively and at a high level, maybe. But, like, say, in Team Fortress 2, that would ruin a multiplayer match, because there's not as much push and pull between the teamwork, you know? But on Modern Warfare 2, you're just jumping in to have some fun for, like, 20-30 minutes and some guy running around.
What I'm saying is I'm not going to have fun if I have to deal with 20 guys running around spamming the knife.
you go in there for Modern Warfare and get attacked by a bunch of knife wielding maniacs.
I mean, it's
he's doing it for the lulz, Dan.
I've got to agree with these guys. It's having faced those guys a number of times, you know, both in the quotes of the Penny Arcade comic, the double shotgun dude is a dog rapist, and I completely agree with that.
There's no debate on that.
I mean, to quote Tycho, yeah, on this point there is consensus.
Yes.
But it makes it into a game I don't want to play. It's not fun to fight against these guys. You don't feel like you're on an equal level.
You wouldn't feel like Modern Warfare. I should say I haven't actually played the multiplayer yet, but just listening to the description of it, it doesn't feel like what the game is supposed to be conveying, which is Modern Warfare.
It's not even that. It's less of a shooter, right? Because there are people running at incredible. Okay, there's a perk where you can run infinitely and you take zero damage from falling, and you can climb ladders, you know, much faster if you get the higher version perk of that. So imagine Team Fortress 2. Running at a higher speed than everybody else consistently, and you can instantly kill. Like, it's like being the scout and the spy together in Team Fortress 2, basically.
What it sounds like is a balanced situation where there is one build that you are stupid not to use if you want to win.
If you want to get points, and that the problem with this design is that's a huge incentive for everybody to unlock new stuff and get your prestige up and get experience and unlock new little icons for your guy and. You know, to get those points that's what you need to do. You need to get more kills, and you need to get bunches of kills together. And for the shotgun build, it's not so much the power of the weapon is one thing, but they're incredibly mobile and they have an amazing amount of accuracy while they're jumping in midair. And that's not really the case with a lot of the other weapons, and it's just very, very frustrating to have.
Can you not make the argument, though, that in the end, it's ultimately not even that much fun for the person who's doing the exploiting. Like, I'm not even necessarily saying it is an exploit, but, you know, if you've got this knife, let's say, for example, and I may be exaggerating a bit, if you've got that knife build, and you can just run around spamming it, and you're going to get the top number of kills every time, you're going to win every game, and you can really just sit there and run around and spam it, and you're not having to really apply yourself or put in a lot of effort, you're just going to win every game. Isn't that just not fun eventually? I mean, you're not, you know, the actual dynamic of the game where you're running and ducking and hiding behind walls and trying to, you know, get the drop on the other guy. That's the way that the game is designed to be fun. If you can usurp that and just run around spamming and win the game that way, sure, you're going to win the game, but isn't the game more about having fun than winning? I don't know.
I absolutely agree.
I'd like to think so, but I mean, we've known for a long time there's people that, for whatever reason, enjoy ruining other people's experiences in games. So, there's that.
But here's a question. Now, knowing what you know now, I know, like, initially, Evan, you said you wouldn't buy this game just because of the lack of dedicated servers. You wouldn't support that. Having played it now, does that recommendation still stand? Has your opinion changed?
Like you said, Dan, I mean, it was entertaining. It was interesting for that period where everybody was getting to know the classes. I was playing with Norm and Will from XPC in a party, and we're sort of going from map to map and, just enjoying the feeling of, like, oh, you got that gun. Oh, how does that work? And, oh, you can call in an airstrike now. That's cool. I'll look forward to getting that. But now that I'm not saying it's devolved into this experience where everyone is playing as these classes, but at least for me, like maybe my tolerance is low for these things, but when one of these people gets into a match, it's frustrating and it distracts you from just having fun, like Gary said. And atop that, I've kind of been discovering more and more that it's a game where you're almost always just killed by people you don't even see. And I don't know, that's fun mostly, but you never really have those moments where you're, at least it's a very small percentage of your combat moments or moments where you're facing off with somebody, you have an honest exchange of ammo or you outthink them. It's just you're running somewhere or you get killed. You're running somewhere or you get killed.
So
yeah, you're right. It's very fast. It's very just like run, and shoot, kill, die, respawn.
Yeah.
But there's no respawn. Right. There's, you know, unless you're playing certain game modes, there's no delay in your respawn. Right. So
worth $60 or no?
No.
Okay.
That's a tough question though, Dan. That's a loaded question.
It's not a loaded question. It is a question of whether or not this game is worth what they're to have and what they're charging for.
That's a javelin exploit loaded question.
I guess you know, as a follow up to that, I would say that the Spec Ops mode, and Eric would agree with me on this, is the most fun we had with the game. I mean, more than multiplayer, more than the campaign.
It's the best part of the game.
Because it takes the best of what the game is, and it eliminates the worst of what we were just talking about with exploits and multiplayer and the frustration and whatever. And it takes those action set pieces, you know, some of which are actually the very same ones you play in the campaign, and you're playing them with another person. And they're you know, much smaller kind of vignette moments of action, which work perfectly.
And since you're playing,
you shouldn't ignore the Spec Ops mode when you talk about how much the game is, if the game is worth the money. Like I found when I was playing Gears of War last year, I didn't play the multiplayer very much, but the Horde mode, where it's like, you know, where it's competitive, where it's cooperative players against the AI enemy, was where I really got the majority of my value out of that game. And I feel like that has the potential to be the case with Modern Warfare 2. I've actually played a bunch of Spec Ops, and it's fun to play competitive in the traditional multiplayer, but I actually prefer now the kind of, I think this is a rising trend, you know, the Left 4 Dead, Horde mode, you know, the zombie mode they put in Call of Duty
Survival.
World War. Now you're seeing it with Spec Ops is this kind of survival style of mode or doing cooperative missions, either, you know, online or whatever. It appeals to me a lot, and I found myself playing more of that than the traditional, you know, deathmatch type stuff.
But I don't know if people made as big a deal as they should have about the $10 PC price increase. Cause I, sure, this game is worth $60, but it's, I mean, really? The price increase? Really? I mean, it's totally worth $50. And I don't know.
But you just said it was worth $60.
It is. That's a problem, though.
You know,
that's
if PC
problem.
Gamers are always going to go on about how their version is the best version, pay the same price as everyone else, you're still getting value.
It's a dangerous right. road.
You want the best version, and you want it cheaper.
Right.
You're damn
I actually
right.
I actually did a story about this a couple months ago.
Oh, okay.
And this was before any of the information came out about how there were going to be, you know, dedicated servers, and it was kind of a not an ideal version on the PC. But I mean, there is a strong case to be made for you know, being willing to pay more for the superior version. Or what we argue to be the superior version. And also, I mean, if you look at inflation over the last, you know, it's been more than 10 years that PC games have pretty much been locked at $50 a pop. If you look at what $50 was worth in today's dollars 10 years ago, it was, you were paying basically, effectively about $66 per $50 game. So for like Half-Life 1, you paid about $66 in okay. $2009.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, arguable that, you know, we're overdue for a price hike. It's great that we, you know, do get to get more for our money right now, but, you know, who's to say how long that's going to last? And, my other argument in that article was that.
What about the fact that they didn't have to produce a physical copy for me?
Well, that's a different thing. That's got to do with, you know, the
retailers.
Online versus brick and mortar retailers. If they undercut them too much online, mm-hmm. the retailers won't carry the game, and then they lose the majority of their sales. So they can't really do that.
And the fact is, I mean, speaking of undercutting, I mean, we have access to some of the best sales, I think, of all game platforms on the PC in the past year or two. I mean, we just got over the Black Friday sales, and I wish I had them in front of me.
Yeah, there were a bunch of great sales this year. I've never seen anything quite like what we saw this year in terms of sales.
I mean, games that were 80% off and things like that are, you know, AAA releases and things like that.
But the other point I wanted to cover was that, you know, if we really want to keep developers on, you know, keep them making games for the PC, then being willing to pay the same amount as they get on other platforms is a great way to do it. Simply because on the other platforms, they have to pay a licensing fee to Microsoft, Nintendo, or Sony to get their games on that platform. On the PC, they'll sell fewer copies because there are fewer PC gamers out there than there are console gamers. So they'll sell fewer copies. But if they sell them at the same price, then they make double the profit margin. They make a significantly larger profit margin per copy sold on the PC, which makes the PC a more attractive platform to publish on.
So what you're saying is one PC gamer is worth two console gamers.
Exactly.
but yeah, just
know,
to
Dan,
hit,
it's a dangerous road. You're going down a dangerous
road.
It is.
I mean, I'm in no way arguing that, hooray, we should pay whatever fanciful price a publisher wants to ask. However, it's hard to say that PC games aren't worth $60 when 10 years ago we were paying effectively $65 for them. And games today cost more to produce. They look better. A lot of them play better. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them. It's hard to argue that that's worth less than it was 10 years ago. Is $60 a fair price to pay for a well-made PC game? Not a badly made PC game, but a well-made PC game. Yes, I think it is.
And again, on top of that, just to touch on the sales, issue. I mean, before Left 4 Dead 2 came out, you had the option to pre-order it for, what was it? I think, 4 copies, you know, among your friends. Same thing with Borderlands, I guess, actually.
Yeah, you could get a 4-pack for what amounted to $35 a person, I think.
Yeah, that was a really ridiculously awesome deal.
And over Black Friday, Left 4 Dead 2 was $38 on sale. KOTOR 2 was $250. I mean, the fact that Valve's only released this year and their biggest game was off, I guess that would be a little bit more than 20%. $12. That's insane. That would never happen at GameStop. That would never happen anywhere else. Right. And, I'm just glad we have access to those kinds of insane money
options.
Options, yes. Thanks. So Dan, myself, and Eric last night, we were attending an event for Telltale. They were celebrating the release of the fifth Monkey Island expansion, which is titled...
Well, Episode.
Episode. Thank you. Rise of the Pirate God, Tales of Monkey Island. As we were carousing and sitting around with everybody, we were sort of pondering the idea of what Telltale should do next. And we've kind of been seeing them as LucasArts Jr., and I don't mean to use that as a bad term necessarily. You know, they've been remaking some of their finest games. Sam and Max, we really enjoyed. I guess they're also doing Wallace and Gromit, which isn't a LucasArts game or product. But there are some properties in LucasArts well that could be reimagined pretty well. Let me just read those off quickly for you guys.
Well, we should specify that the Telltale has for people who don't know, they have an episodic model where they take and they make adventure games. So they take a property like Monkey Island, And they make an episodic adventure game out of it that comes out every month. They have put out 4 episodes of Monkey Island so far. The fifth one is about to come out. And after they put out like a series of 5 or so episodes, then they take a break. With Sam and Max, they put out a second season of Sam and Max. So a second season of Monkey Island is certainly an option. But they have said that they want to do some other stuff that's not Monkey Island, not Sam and Max.
This reminds me of their panel at PAX, which basically turned into, are you guys planning on creating my insert favorite adventure game from past here?
Yeah.
Right.
But let's kind of focus on what we think is the most probable, you know, other than an original IP, which they could certainly surprise us with. I'd like to think Grim Fandango is off limits because I'd like to think LucasArts themselves would want to take that up.
And I don't know.
I think it's untouchable. I think they should never bring that back. I think it's...
What makes you think that LucasArts wants to do it?
Because it's, like Andy said, it's such a valued property within the sort of adventure gaming community.
Does it have to be a LucasArts franchise?
Well, it doesn't have to be LucasArts franchise.
Gabriel Knight then.
Well, it was also Grim Fandango was also fairly recent too. I mean, I think, you know, they seem to with Sam and Max and certainly Monkey Island, it's been more about going back more into the vault. So I would imagine that if they wanted to kind of, you know, continue to play up that, you know, bringing up the old classics back out of the archive, it'd be, you know, Maniac Mansion and, you know, Zack McCracken, that kind of stuff.
What about Full Throttle or Day of the Tentacle?
Day of the Tentacle was just a follow-up to Maniac. I would go back to the beginning. Yeah. I mean, Maniac Mansion, if I'm not wrong, was Lucasfilm Games' first ever, you know, graphic adventure. And that seems like if you're going to go all the way back to the source, that would be a good one to do.
And as much as a lot of people played Maniac Mansion, it's not as known or played today, I'd like to think. So they might have a little bit more license to do what they like with it. I think that would be a great fit, personally.
I think you may have hit on something, Dan, with Full Throttle.
Yeah. And I think that Telltale, based on their past catalog, they've done Strong Bad, going back to their first episodic project was the Bone games, which was based off of a graphic novel. They only ended up making two of those, and that was because I'm guessing it wasn't as successful as they'd hoped it would be. They moved on from there to Sam and Max, which was very successful. So I think what they need a good IP to build one of these franchises off of. One of these seasons off of. I think they doing a new IP would be very dangerous for them. I think they need something established, something with a good following among the existing adventure game community. And I think that's probably why they will likely go back to the LucasArts well, or maybe go off of some other popular web comic. Or other, something along those lines. But obviously, Penny Arcade they can't do.
See, I was just gonna say, you know, Dave Grossman works for Telltale Games now, and he did Day of the Tentacle, so that would be the most obvious to me, is like Maniac Mansion and Day of the Tentacle. He knows that stuff. He helped write it.
Yeah, it'd be great to have, you know, the original guys. And actually, Telltale was founded by some of the guys who left, LucasArts, the adventure game department, and started up Telltale. So,
or and this is a, probably, I'm sure, much more of a licensing nightmare, but do some Indiana Jones adventures. I mean, those were the last really good Indiana Jones games.
True. Yeah, I mean, they do have the relationship with Lucas, though, so it's not as big of a nightmare as you would probably think. I mean, they've got the existing relationship going on there.
But still, it's not something that they can. It's not something that just the CEO of LucasArts could greenlight. Like, they've got to go to George, and it's all got to fit in the big plan, you know. So,
true.
Well, probably a little bit more tricky. But you know, I think since Fate of Atlantis, you know, they've tried to reboot the Indiana Jones game franchise many times, and aside from the Lego games, I don't think they've ever had any real success with it. So that might be a good, you know, back to the well from when those games are actually good.
That's true. Although I don't know if Indiana Jones would be a good property for Telltale style. I mean, those old indie adventure games, you know, they were as realistic as they could be based on, you know, on like really 2D sprite graphics. I don't know if Telltale's engine would lend itself to that. And I think that would be a little bit more than they could chew. Although I guess they do the CSI games, don't they?
Yeah, they did one, didn't they?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I don't know, I didn't play that one. So maybe they do have it in them. I don't know.
I'm trying to think.
And in fact, the episodic nature of it really kind of goes back to the episodic nature of those old Republic serials that the Indiana Jones movie was based on to begin with.
Right.
So it would actually kind of feel like really going back to the original style of the inspiration.
Yeah.
Tune in next month, you know, for the next exciting episode.
Yeah. That's a great thought. And either way, it's kind of reassuring that, at least to us, from our seat, they have these good options available to them that they could execute in different ways that would be interesting. So, just looking forward to what they're going to do next. We all really enjoyed Tales.
Did they give you a hint at all, or did they lead you on in any direction?
They did not. No.
I was trying to think, like, because you've got Strong Bad, you've got Walls and Ground, which are like not traditional adventure game properties, right? And I was thinking, what else could they pull from that's like an animation style character that they could turn into an adventure game, and maybe something from Disney Pixar. I don't know.
Maybe Dr. McNinja. Sorry, my favorite webcomic thing.
Outstanding. All right. So moving past Telltale. So EA's plans, according to Might and Magic creator John Van Canningham, who's actually transitioned from Trion World Networks to join EA, to lead the Command & Conquer brand itself. So according to this guy, Command & Conquer is going to be transitioning into a new digital model that is going to reignite the fan base for this franchise. And the first thing I thought of when I read this quote was, okay, look at what they've done with the EA has done with the Battlefield series in the past year. You know, they've taken Battlefield Heroes Online, made it into a microtransaction model. They made it browser-based, I guess.
Well, it's not exactly browser-based.
You start the game through your browser, either way, and you access your stats and whatever through your browser. Would this be a viable model for Command & Conquer, sort of knowing that, according to a rumor, that the Command & Conquer team, at least some of it, is going to be closed out after Tiberian Twilight is released?
I think it is a valid model. I mean, there hasn't really been, well, it's a valid experiment anyway. There hasn't really been a free to play RTS of that high profile. Although, I mean, you could say the same thing with Battlefield Heroes, and now there's the whole controversy. They just kind of tweaked it to strongly encourage you to buy the microtransaction stuff. It used to be you could play it and just earn all the stuff in game for free. And now they've really pissed off their player base, by jacking up those prices, to the point where you can't practically earn stuff in game. You have to buy it. So who knows how successful that's actually been for them. I think the fact that the Tiberian Twilight is PC only. That's CNC4. It's PC only, unlike Command & Conquer 3 and Red Alert 3, which both had console releases. I think that probably speaks poorly of EA's confidence in the brand as a console brand. So they seem to be, going with the digital distribution model, which is, pretty strongly in the PC camp right now. It saves them from having to do a retail release, so it cuts down on costs like that, which they also did with the Red Alert 3 expansion, which was digital only. So I think it's practical.
Yeah, I mean, if they're saying this is going to be something that reignites the fan base, that sort of gives me the feeling that they feel like they've lost a lot of people over the franchise's timeline. Where, I mean, Red Alert was a huge success. The original Red Alert was a huge success. So was the original Command & Conquer. I feel like less people bought those games as they went on. So what would get people back into the franchise might be, something less intimidating, where you can actually play a multiplayer match. You know, maybe it's a more casual experience online. Fewer units, lower end hardware spec, and 20-minute matches maximum or something. I don't know.
And it would be kind of interesting if they were to make a browser-based version of like Red Alert 1. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's technically feasible at this point to do that. And to have a basic RTS in there, or like a remake with better graphics than the original, and maybe a few control enhancements, but do more or less a straight up remake of the original games and put them up online for free or low cost.
It's so unfortunate. I just want to say this. It's so unfortunate the way that just the word itself, Twilight, has been so
Sully.
I cannot think about this game now without thinking about like GDI versus Nod versus vampires versus werewolves like that.
Well, Kane is a vampire. You know that, right? He doesn't age.
That's why he doesn't age. That's why he's been around since World War II, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, while we ponder that, let's take some reader questions and listener questions.
Hello, PC Gamer crew. This is Canoe once again from Ontario, Canada. I had a question about an incident that occurred when I was playing Dragon Age. Specifically, I went in to play Dragon Age the other day, and it told me that my save game could not be loaded and I could not access the game because I had content that was not authorized. I was a little bit confused, not sure what had happened until I realized that I had temporarily lost my internet connection with my wireless LAN. Since then, my wireless box has been having issues, and I'm in the process of getting that fixed. But any time that I lose network connection, I am unable to access my older save games and play the game because I have content that requires online authentication. Just wanted to know your comments on the frustration of being tied to the internet on a strictly single-player game, and why this would be something that game companies do, because it's really, really annoying.
Well, that's a sneaky little trick. I didn't realize they did, but it makes sense. Dragon Age itself has no internet activation DRM. It doesn't. You can play it completely offline if you want, which you know is a huge win for DRM haters everywhere. You don't have to deal with activation limits or any crap like that. So, you know, 10 years down the line, you'll be able to put Dragon Age in your supercomputer and play it. But with the DLC, like Warden's Keep and Stone Prisoner, and I forget what the other one's called, those, I guess they require you to log in to their servers to use. And it's, you know, pretty clear why they do that, which is because if they didn't, then you could freely copy those and give them to your friends, like really, really easily. There would be no disk check or anything like there is on Dragon Age itself. So that is an inconvenience if you like to play offline. But, it's pretty clear why they do it.
I'd like to think it would have been possible to, I'm not sure what the correct term for this is, to, you know, lock the DLC or encode it in a certain way that, your computer recognizes it. That doesn't need an internet connection every single time, but that's the model they use. Like you said, it's kind of, it was surprising to me because I wasn't aware of this. And I always, there's, when you start Dragon Age, like in the lower left corner, you can log into, their, I guess it's called the BioWare social network.
Right, they have social page that puts up all your achievements and stuff.
Yeah, and they're going to use the same thing for Mass Effect 2, conceivably, you know, publishes your achievements and your progress and certain screenshots if you'd like. But yeah, I didn't know I did that. That's pretty lame, honestly.
So if you buy the DLC, you can't play just the DLC portion unless you're logged in online, or you can't play the entire game.
No. You wouldn't be able to play a saved game that you had played where you had been using the DLC to get where you were.
Okay.
So any game that has a dependency on the DLC, you couldn't play. So it's a nasty little catch.
Yeah. It's definitely annoying. And I'd probably assume on PC that Mass Effect 2 will do the same thing. We've already heard about their plans for DLC for Mass Effect 2. And they'll probably use the same infrastructure considering they're going to integrate it with the social network.
Yeah, almost certainly. Yeah, there's not a whole lot you can do. Although, I mean, generally speaking, most people are totally connected all the time, and like I never would have noticed this unless my internet service completely died on me.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, PC Gamer Podcast. This is Roger in Columbus, Ohio, home of the Ohio State Buckeyes and the heart of Big Ten country. Listen, I got two quick questions for you today. The first has to do with screenshots, capturing in-game screenshots. Just curious about what software you use. Preferably, I'd like to get something that is free or shareware that does a really good job. My second question, as the father of three kids, two boys, 11 and 7, who are really starting to get into PC gaming, I was curious if you might have ever considered adding a kids section to your magazine or a kids choice or a family-friendly offering as far as gaming for the month, or maybe a little section in there. Anyway, love the magazine. Long-time subscriber and long-time listener to the podcast. Keep up the great work, and thanks a lot.
On the second question, I'm certainly glad to hear that your kids are interested in PC gaming at a young age. It's fantastic. That's what I grew up on.
They're being raised right.
Absolutely. Precisely. So while I hate to recommend a IGN-owned website, whatthayplay.com has some very handy reviews on sort of games for a parent's perspective, you know, whether it's content appropriate or whether it's easy to play and in terms of interface and mechanics and things like that. So that's worth checking out. I'm not sure if we have any immediate plans for a kids section or a kids recommendation section. It would probably involve Nancy Drew reviews for my liking.
Yeah, I mean, we generally see our focus as you know, older, not older gamers, but you know, the type of gamer enthusiast who doesn't generally necessarily have kids, and you know, kid gaming is not necessarily our focus, I guess is the point. But we do review some kiddie games. Generally they aren't very good. I guess the last one we did was the Star Wars Clone Wars game. And you know, we almost always have at least one or two E-rated games in there for that are, you know, family friendly. But as we don't you know, call it out so much.
Yeah. And regarding what we use to capture screenshots, which I'd like to think a simple Google search would solve, but we do enjoy the services of Fraps, and you can find them at Fraps, that's FRAPS.com. It is a paid utility if you don't want the watermark.
Yeah, you can get the shareware version, but it does stamp like Fraps on every screenshot, which, you know, it depends on what you're doing, what you're using that for, but it's what, $30?
37. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's if you're going to take a lot of screenshots, it's definitely like the best one we've ever used out there. It works in, especially the new version, works in damn near everything. And actually now it at least with Windows 7 and Vista, I'm not sure about XP, but it will handle screenshots of the desktop as well, which it never used to do.
Oh, that's nice.
Outside and of DirectX. You gave away your secret where you just do a movie and then you pick out the frames, right?
Right. That's my technique these days is I capture. I use Fraps to capture movies of the game as I'm playing it,
yeah.
Or you know, as I see something interesting coming up, because these movies do suck up a lot of disk space, so it's like a gigabyte a minute, maybe a little bit more. So if you see something cool about to happen, you turn on the video and play for a minute and then try and get in close and get some cool stuff happening on screen. And then later you get to go back and pick out, I use Virtual Dub for this. It's a free, video utility. You can capture specific frames. You can go through frame by frame and capture the specific one. And I paste that into XNView, which is another free program. That's how I do it. And the benefit of that is you're not hammering a screenshot key while you're trying to position everything.
Yeah.
So,
God bless PC gaming. I know some of the Xbox magazine guys have to, sort of the best configuration they can do is to, they have a foot pedal device that, you know, triggers the screen capture through their utility and through like the Xbox debug.
Yeah, it's all jury rigged together. And it used to be the console games, they had to actually photograph the screen.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. Two people, operation people. That's crazy. All right, one more, Andy.
Hi guys, this is Ryan from Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'm just curious. I see online these images of these LAN events that have hundreds of people last several days. How in the world do people keep from getting their stuff swiped over this period of time? Thanks. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work.
Well, the short answer is most of the people that go to these events, they're either going with a team, they're going with some group of friends, or they make friends there even sometimes, and you're not always wandering off leaving nobody watching your stuff. That's kind of the simplest way of answering. I know there are some devices, I guess, that allow you to lock your case or lock it down to a table or something. I haven't seen them before, but I've heard about them.
There definitely is a problem at LAN events, though.
Yes. Staff usually, you know, they do a good job at making sure that you're walking in only people that are at the LAN are allowed in. You know what I mean? Like, you have to have a lanyard and stuff. And so not just, like, anybody can walk in and then leave with a computer.
But it's still, I mean, yeah, it depends on the event, you know, how much attention they've given to security. I mean, you definitely don't want to just walk away and leave your stuff there. That's a recipe for disaster.
At PAX, they had a check-in, check-out thing. So to bring a computer out of there, you had to have like a ticket, I think.
Right.
Yeah. They basically had escorts. Like, you couldn't even walk around on the floor without someone like asking you where you're going, basically. If I remember correctly,
it's resource intensive to provide that much security. You got to have a whole security team if you really want to be thorough and prevent any kind of theft, and that's expensive. So a lot of places won't do it, and you're kind of on your own.
Yeah, it helps that PAX has such a strong following that they have a massive team of volunteers that they actually call enforcers, which they have stamped in the back of their T-shirts, and they fill that role pretty well, I'd say.
Wear kilts.
They do.
But if you're just going to a small local LAN, don't turn your back.
All right. So thanks for your questions and comments this week, guys. If you'd like to submit one for next week, give us a ring as always at the number 877-404-1337, extension 724. Please keep your question or comment under 1 minute. And if you prefer to submit via MP3, just shoot us an email at pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com. All right, looks like we've got last up our playlist for this week. Andy Bauman, I'm curious what you've been up to.
Oh, dude, I've actually been playing a lot of games. you know, as much as I can fit in. I guess it's been 2 weeks, that's why. I played the latest Monkey Island episode. Actually, not the latest, but episode 3. And then I've been playing Modern Warfare 2 and Dragon Age. So it's been a really good week. Yeah.
How far are you in Dragon Age?
I'm not far at all, but I'm like, I was playing it right before I had to start doing the podcast today, and just like, oh, these fights are so intense. Like, I'm like, okay, can I take on this next group of bad guys? All right, I got 15 minutes. It's probably going to take me about 15 minutes just to get through like 4 of these guys. I don't know. Like, it's intense. I love the combat so much.
Great. Yeah, it's really well balanced for me on normal. I know some people have been complaining in certain battles, but it's been perfect for me.
Yeah, I mean, there's been times where I'm wiping, and I'm just like, are you serious? How am I supposed to do this? But then, you know, it just comes down to ninja pausing and queuing up stuff, so.
Yeah. What's your origin, Andy?
I did Elf Mage. And I'm curious because there's been a lot of payoff so far as an Elf Mage.
Do you have any gay sex in the game yet?
Not yet.
Not that kind.
I don't know. There's been a lot of payoff though, because there's a character, you know, that comes up in the origin story, and he's actually already reappeared in my game as an important crossroads sort of thing. I'm wondering if that happens if like you do every story, you know.
I think each of the origins has sort of one character like that, but it just depends on how you approach things that you sort of chronologically run into them.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. Do you start in a different city, or do you pretty much go to that Korosari Wilds first?
Everybody goes to Korosari Wilds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm wondering, because I've already run into this guy, and I'm wondering if you play a different origin story and you go to Redcliff right afterwards, you run into the guy and you wouldn't have no idea who he was. And it would just happen that way, or does they plant him? You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know.
I don't know who the guy is, so it's hard to say.
Yeah. I would be interested to see how that works out.
You don't have to go to Redcliff right after, if I'm correct.
No, you don't have to, but if you did,
we'll have to construct a web of events sometime. I'd be curious to see that.
Yeah.
All right, Dan. I know you've been playing a bunch of games for review, but right. Is there anything you can talk about?
Well, I've been playing Monkey Island. I just finished episode 4 the night before last, which does have a surprise ending, which I didn't really see the twist coming, which I should have. I guess I wasn't really thinking about it. If I had sat down and thought about what's the twist going to be, this is the twist I probably would have seen coming. But it was an entertaining game. Or entertaining episode of that game. I think that they're doing a really strong job with it. There's generally like one puzzle per game, per episode that annoys me. It's like, well, how the hell was I supposed to figure that out? But most of them are, and you do eventually by just experimentation. Most of them are really entertaining and satisfying to figure out. So, and the writing is funny too. So, and what else? I still sneak in the occasional, round of Left 4 Dead and I'm playing Modern Warfare 2 in very, very slow, the single player, very, very slow chunks. I really need to just power through the rest of that just so I'm not so far behind everybody else.
Eric Belsauce, tell me what you got.
Let's see. Well, when I have little bits of time to be playing games, I have been loving Gyromancer so much. It's got the addictiveness of PopCap. It's very puzzle questy, but it's different enough that I'm enjoying playing through it. And then in my larger time spans, I finally caved in and decided to start playing some adventure games because of this Telltale event. And I am adoring Sam and Max. It's got great humor. It's well written. It's got fantastic puzzles. So it's so much fun. So I've been having pretty outside of Spec Ops with you, Evan. I've been having a pretty casual gameplay experience, but I've been having a lot of fun.
Mr. Witta, outside of Modern Warfare 2, which you mentioned, anything else?
Yeah, a little Modern Warfare 2. I've been playing Warcraft as usual. Keeps coming back. I kind of screwed up when Lich King came out. I got sucked into the whole Death Knight thing, and I spent a lot of time making and leveling a Death Knight, and I got it to level 80, and then subsequently after that discovered I didn't really like the Death Knight very much. So then I just kind of tossed that character and went back to my main and started leveling that character to 80. But it's a long process. I don't know how players have all these multiple alts, because I only really enjoy the leveling, the questing process the first time out. Like, going back and doing all the quests that you've done before a second time with another character is not as much fun. So it's a lot slower for me. I'm trying to get my character up to my character currently is at 77. I'm trying to get into 80 before Cataclysm comes out, but it seems like Cataclysm's not coming out for ages, so I've got loads of time, so I'm kind of leveling at a very leisurely pace right now. And playing a lot of New Super Mario Brothers on Wii, which is probably going to be my favorite game of the year, with four players crowded around the TV playing that. It's the most fun you can have with your clothes on.
A ringing endorsement.
Well, I think the problem is Gaz just hasn't tried playing it naked yet.
Yeah, let us know how that goes if you do. All right, Apprentice.
I haven't played a single thing, man. Nothing.
Really?
I watched The Wire. Like, I finished all five seasons. That was it.
That's good. I'm in the middle of watching that right now. As is
normal. How far are you?
Episode 4.
So no, it gets better. Much better.
I'm looking forward to it. As for myself, I guess we've been putting some good amount of time into Scavenge and Left 4 Dead, which is our favorite mode of Left 4 Dead 2. Gosh, I don't know. I kind of stopped playing Modern Warfare 2 for the aforementioned reasons. There's something else I'm forgetting. Oh, yeah. I've cautiously promised with my girlfriend that we're going to try and play Mass Effect together, if that doesn't sound incredibly impossible. She liked Dragon Age, but she was sort of thrown off by the combat, and now it's pausable and very tactical, and real time might be a better fit. And plus, I'm going to try and get her to surprise her by sort of tricking her into having sex with a woman. So that'll be fun.
You're still talking about the game, right?
Yeah. I have grand plans. Yeah,
But it doesn't sound implausible. I mean, Deathlock was telling me he did a playthrough of Dragon Age with his wife, where you know he was driving and she was calling the shots and all the decision making.
That's really cool. I would have loved to have seen that. I wonder if that was like his third playthrough, or like, I can just imagine like her. I don't know. I've never met Deathlock's wife, but like, I just imagine like her sitting on his lap and like he's smoking a cigar, and just like calling out like the ability types and like min maxing. And
I'm gonna go tell Deathlock you're fantasizing about his wife.
All right. And on that note, I want to thank all you guys for joining us this week, especially Gary Witta. Thanks for taking some of your time for us.
Always happy to be here.
Good.
Sorry. And Logan says he regrets that he could not join the podcast this week, but he pledges that he will be on next week with a disclaimer. Unless he is eaten by a Gru.
Which is always a possibility around our offices. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Enjoy the weekend, and talk to you soon.
All right. Has anyone eaten lunch?
No.
I did.
Wanna go?
Starving.
Come on, Andy.
Drive to Salt Lake. Eat with the others.